I'm John Krall. Coming up on No Limits, we will talk about the changes and challenges confronting the news business. The combination of an economic downturn and a revolution in communications technology has created an earthquake of change in newspaper, television, and radio newsrooms. In some places, newsroom staffing is half what it was just 5 years ago. Just recently, the Indianapolis Star laid off more than 60 employees, and the Louisville Courier-Journal made equally deep cuts in its staffing, including shutting down its Statehouse Bureau. We'll talk about how this has changed news gathering and what it means to you with Mizell Stewart, the editor of the Evansville Courier and Press, Leslie Stedman Weidenbinner, formerly the Statehouse Bureau Chief for the Louisville Courier-Journal, and Ken Owen, currently with DePauw University, but formerly a longtime radio and television reporter and anchor. And, of course, you. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about shrinking newsrooms and really the changes and challenges confronting the news business. We're fortunate to have as our guest today Ken Owen, who is currently with DePauw University. Actually, that makes it sound like it's relatively recent and temporary. You've been there for quite a while, but you're here because you were a longtime radio and television reporter with WIBC and with WISH here. Ken, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. I'm a ghost from journalism past, and I'm happy to be here today.
Oh, great. Well, we'll figure out if we're going to go all Dickens on this thing, who's going to fit the other roles. We also have with us in the studio Leslie Stedman Weidenbinner, who is formerly the Indiana State House Bureau Chief for the Louisville Courier Journal. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And on the phone, we have Mizell Stewart, who is the editor of the Evansville Courier and Press. Mizell, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
Glad to have you here. And I should start this show with my listeners by doing sort of a blanket disclosure. I tried to think of all of the possible conflicts here that I had and decided would exhaust the hour. I've worked with all of these folks in the past in one capacity or another and consider them colleagues and friends, so I probably just ought to put that out there so people understand it. We would like you to join the conversation. You can call us at 1-866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, let's talk a little bit about really what's brought us to this point. I mean, why are we having to shrink newsrooms? Why is the news business under such pressure right now? And I think, Mizell, I'll start with you on that one. What do you think has brought the business to this point?
I think what is happening in the news business is alternatively a dilemma of scarcity and scale. I mean, the reason that local media organizations were able to grow as large as they had been able to grow was really a product of scarcity. There were few places to get information, and particularly in communities such as Indianapolis and Evansville, the newspapers really became the dominant marketplace for advertising, and particularly classified advertising. Classified advertising was a very high-margin business for us, and quite literally financed a great expansion in local newsrooms in the 80s and 90s to the point where I remember at the time was working in Ohio and was with the Akron Beacon Journal, and we were expanding into suburban areas and opening bureaus and we're really flush with cash. But what happened to us essentially was the ability of national players powered by the internet to reach into local markets and develop businesses of national scale. And so that has put local media companies and those companies that are really focused on local markets under a great deal of pressure.
Ken Owen, why do you think we're here?
Well, I think Mizell is touching a key point. The other thing is that many of these media entities these days are publicly traded companies. And I remember back in the 90s, the very robust 90s, where the station I was working for had a 35% to 40% profit margin.
Mm-hmm.
And that was typical of stations back then. Advertising would come in. Election years were total gravy. And the money train just never seemed to stop. And what happened was, as the media landscape began to change, as Mizell said, you now can go to any number of sources and learn about any number of things, including your neighbor's blog about your block. It's become very localized. One conversation we may have today is just, you know, the trustworthiness of information, the validity of what you're reading. That's a whole other thing.
We are going to get to the point where we talk about whether what these changes are costing the audience.
Yeah, because people are not very good consumers of news. They think they are. But it is important to have people there vetting information for you. But I remember a meeting in 1995. We had a consultant that used to come to Channel 8, and he, of course, went to many cities and said, I think the very same thing, which is why we have this homogenization of local news. But he got off the plane, probably had a gin and tonic on the plane, and came up with his plan for the day, which was what we needed to be was news in progress. You know, it didn't matter what happened last night. It doesn't matter what happens tomorrow. We're going to tell people what happened now. And I think the two things that really started us down this bad trail, and again, Mizell's very correct in that people now have all these sources, but the helicopter became the main source of disseminating local news. And of course, following a jarheaded teenager driving the wrong way on 65 for 45 minutes wall-to-wall is not news. But for a while, and I think continuing today, it is news. And then overnight ratings. We went from a point where you would just bust tail every day to do the best job you could, and four times a year a book would come in the mail, and the news director would stand up at a board and say, we're number one, or we're number two, or we're number three, or we did well, or we didn't, to coming in the next morning and seeing how you did in a quarter hour. And I remember a general manager literally looking at that sheet saying, what the H happened at 5:45? And the sun might have come out for the first time in 5 days, and people were walking their dogs. But they were wondering, why did the audience diminish? And so
just real quickly here, I want to make sure that we don't, because we are all professionals, don't devolve into too much jargon. Could you explain to the listeners what a book is here when they talk about that and why it's important, significant?
A book is essentially, they do monitor audience viewership, and it's a shard of the audience, but it's deemed to be statistically accurate and measurable. But four times a year in the old days, we would literally, based on the diaries that people would fill out at home, they would say, I watch Channel 8 or I watch Channel 6 or 13. We would know where we lined up in terms of number one, number two, or number three in the ratings. Those numbers then would determine how much we could charge for advertising. And so the stakes were quite high. It's almost like, you know, Clark Griswold's Christmas bonus. You're waiting there for that thing to arrive, and hopefully the news is good and the check is big. But when you start to look at numbers on a day-to-day basis, and it's like a president's polling numbers, when you start paying too much attention to those things, you start to make crazy changes to the way you operate. And it's not about journalism. It's about marketing.
Mm-hmm. Leslie, what do you think? You've operated, obviously, inside a newsroom for more years than either one of us would care to admit.
Sure.
What do you think?
Well, as you can
point?
Tell just from listening to all of us talk, I mean, this is an extremely complicated problem. I'm not sure that we all know exactly what the problem really is at its root, and it may just be a confluence of many things. But I did want to play off something Mizell said, which is talking about advertising. And one of the issues is that we have really newspapers, TV, radio have trained readers over the years and listeners to want news for nearly nothing, for almost free. We relied on advertising so much for so long that that we have given away newspapers for 50 cents or 75 cents, which to a lot of people doesn't seem that cheap. But, I mean, it's less than a cup of coffee these days. And it gets delivered to your door, sits on the doorstep for you to get up in the morning with all of this new local news in it. And we've just trained people to be so dependent on free news. And now with the internet and all of this news out there for free, it's just a model that can't really be sustained, especially as you move on to the internet where advertising is not nearly as lucrative as it once was. We've created a real problem for ourselves.
Did the business make a mistake by, you know, offering content, we use the term, for free on the internet. By content, we mean stories here.
It's hard to say. I mean, it's hard to know what would have happened had newspapers and other media just decided to charge from the very beginning. Maybe that would have worked. Maybe it wouldn't have. But I really do think you have to look beyond just when the internet came around. I mean, the product has been provided for free or next to nothing for a very long time. But you know, there are some experiments now with putting news behind paywalls, with requiring people to pay a little bit. Some newspapers and media organizations are doing that by letting some have a little bit of news for free and then maybe starting to charge after you look at so many articles a month. There's a lot of experimentation going on right now, and maybe somebody will hit on something that works well.
Now, we see stories, or at least I see stories, where, you know, in some cases, European newspapers or Canadian newspapers are not feeling quite the same pressure that we are, because historically they shifted more of the cost of the actual news gathering to subscribers, weren't quite as dependent upon advertisers. Mizell Stewart, is that the case? I mean, is that one of the answers, perhaps, is to start shifting some of the costs back to subscribers?
Well, absolutely. I think the reality, and if you go back in the history of local journalism, people really have never paid for news. The forebear of what is today the E.W. Scripps company, Edward Willis Scripps, he couldn't stand advertising, and he came of age as a newspaper baron around the times of Hearst and Pulitzer, and he hated advertising so much that he virtually forbade his editors and general managers to accept it, and he wanted to get most of his money from subscribers who paid a penny a paper. And what that led to, though, was some really lean newspaper staffs. In 1906, the staff of the Scripps paper in Denver, Colorado, and I'm talking about the whole newsroom advertising and circulation staff, was five people. And what happened was editors and general managers realized that in order to serve the community, they needed to get another source of revenue. So they literally defied the founder of the company and began to accept advertising in greater and greater numbers. And as a result, that advertising revenue allowed them to expand their newsrooms. And so advertising has always been a part of it. You know, broadcast and cable media generate advertising revenue, but increasingly subscription revenue that's coming from cable and satellite providers are also a piece of the revenue pie now. And so there's going to have to be more of the burden of expense is going to have to be borne by subscribers, but it's going to be a tough slog when we haven't really demanded that people ask for that.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener, Scott Leadingham, who actually cautions us to remember that you can't just talk about newsroom as traditional media, that there is much investment in digital public media and nonprofit news right now. Part of that, we've got just a couple of minutes until the break, though, is what we're talking about here is that the process has opened up. When I entered the business, back when dinosaurs still roamed the earth, really the entry barriers to getting into the news business were huge. I mean, even if you were going to buy the smallest newspaper, the smallest radio station, if you didn't have a multimillionaire's capacity at your beck and call, you weren't going to get into the game. Now, pretty much anyone who can afford maybe $10 a month to rent some space in a server and has access, doesn't even own, but has access to a computer, can call himself or herself a publisher. Is that a good thing or a bad thing, Ken Owen?
We each have a printing press and broadcast tower in our dens, which is a very powerful thing. And I think it cuts both ways. I think there are people out there that are doing a terrific job of being essentially citizen journalists and communicating in real time things that a newspaper has to sit on for a while. And yet there's just a lot of gunk out there and a lot of noise. And the tweeter makes a very good point. I mean, I think that it's a wide open world right now, and there are things probably that are being disseminated that wouldn't in the past for various reasons, some good, some bad. But I do think that the basic problem is that if you go to Yahoo News, you go to Google News 24/7, you get a listing of the top five or six stories. We've become headline scanners. There are very, very few people that devour a newspaper in the way that people did 10 or 15 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago. And I worry that our appetite for information is changing, and newsrooms are adapting to that appetite by dumbing it down. If Paris Hilton goes outside without a dress on someday, that's big news. If something happens in the Middle East,
it's big news on the Internet. It's not necessarily big news in the paper.
Or in the world.
Mm-hmm. I think we are going to have to pick this up again in a second. We're talking about the changes and challenges in the news business with our guests, Mizell Stewart to the Evansville Courier and Press, Leslie Stedman Weidenbender, and Ken Owen. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about the changes and challenges confronting the news business with our guests, Leslie Stedman Weidenbender, formerly the Indiana State House Bureau Chief for the Louisville Courier-Journal, Ken Owen, currently with DePauw University, but a longtime radio and television anchor with WIBC and WISH-TV here in Indianapolis, and Mizell Stewart, who is the editor of the Evansville Courier and Press. And we were talking really about how the whole process has opened up, and I would suggest, I want to continue on that theme a little bit here, because I think we're all probably on the same page in that we think there's some good things about that, and that it has opened things up and allowed more people to get in the game. But nothing in life comes without cost. What are the costs that come with the fact that the barriers have come down to some degree?
Well, let me jump in here.
Sure, please.
Talk about how another way that the democratization of the tools of distribution has really kicked the legs out from under traditional media. Everyone is a content producer. One of the most frightening conversations I've had in recent years was about 5 years ago. Was on an airplane, and the guy sitting next to me was the marketing director for a home builder in Phoenix, Arizona, and he was describing for me how their company's plan was to pull 90% of their advertising out of the Arizona Republic, because they no longer needed to advertise. What they needed to do was to drive traffic to their own website. In other words, every business is now a producer, a creator of content. Granted, it's in a marketing sense, but again, what it means is that people no longer need to access traditional media in order to reach audiences. They can do so digitally. And what we see with social media such as Twitter and Facebook, I think, is only going to accelerate that trend, because what social media is going to allow marketers to do is to reach their audiences one-to-one on a much more personal level. And it's the kind of relationship that traditional media can only dream of, because, again, the economic underpinning is gone when we're no longer able to capture that audience through the production of credible news content, package that audience and sell that audience, and in effect pay for news that way.
Leslie Stedman Weidenbender.
Well, I think one of the concerns is that newspapers and traditional media in general have fallen behind a little bit when it comes to the innovation of trying to figure out ways, as Mizell said, of finding that way to target customers and to target people with advertising. I really believe traditional media can find ways to keep up. One thing to do is to stop thinking of us as traditional media and start really thinking of ourselves as companies that don't have one delivery system. The one thing, though, I hate to see happen is that in a traditional news organization, there's a sense of agenda setting, which the public, I think, retaliates against a little bit. But the one great thing, for instance, about your newspaper coming on your front doorstep is when you pick it up, you believe that the editors have chosen the top stories to put on the front page. You can feel like if you read the front page, if you read maybe the front of the local section, the front of the sports page, you've gotten a sense of what the most important things is going on. When you rely on the internet, on Facebook, on social media, on all of these different things, there's no agenda setting. Whatever happens to be sort of the news of the moment, it might be news of a celebrity. Those are the things that are up top. Those are the things that are being promoted. And you lose that sense that you know about the most important thing going on in your community.
Yeah, I just saw a documentary on how the New York Times is dealing with the emergence of all of these new media, called Page One, that is fascinating and makes pretty much that same point, except it expands on it. It's not just that, you know, without the Times, no one's setting the agenda. Really, without the traditional or legacy media, I guess, is now the new term that they're using. Without those media, not only do we not have an agenda, but there really isn't a Robert's Rules of Order anymore mm-hmm. for our community conversations, that we don't quite know how to conduct them. So real quickly, if everybody is now a journalist, what are we losing? And I know I'm speaking to a crowd that's got a vested interest in here. All of us do. What are we losing by not relying on professional journalists?
Well, let me just jump in real fast, because I can see, actually, even though I can't see you. There are some listeners out there shaking their heads saying agenda setting. That's the whole problem. To draw an analogy.
Please,
I can go online and buy stock for $3.99 a trade.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody should be online trading their portfolios.
Mm-hmm.
I can go online and figure out what the top 20 news stories are today based on my personal preferences or what my worldview or whatever that is. No day of the week would it be Paris Hilton,
okay.
But there is value in going to a site like the New York Times or the Washington Post, gazing at that page and saying, what has changed in our world that has some meaning? And I think that's an invaluable resource that professional journalism provides people. It provides us tomorrow's history today. Somebody is there vetting, not politically, but they're vetting what is important and what is less important, and putting them in a certain order for us to digest. And there's also the archival value of the things that newspapers and television stations have created for years. We've all spent time on the Times website, other newspapers' websites, reading about ancestors, things that have happened in the past, old obituaries. That's all very valuable stuff that isn't part of the new world. It's very flavor of the moment. It's very pop, pop, pop. So I want to put in a
plug for local media organizations, because I'm not convinced that the sun is setting on traditional local media organizations. I know that what has been happening at the Star and what's been happening has happened over the years at our newspaper and other newspapers across the country, and also broadcast outlets is a real challenge, and we're in this mode where literally what is happening is we're taking the cost structure and revamping it for the revenue that we have right now. But I think the future of the local media organization is taking advantage of scale and being a multi-platform organization. I don't care if you want the information in the newspaper. I don't care if you want it on radio. I don't care if you want it on television. I don't care if you want it once a month on a magazine, if you want it on a Kindle, if you want it on an iPad, if you want it on your mobile phone. It's all a matter of, how do we preserve the core of local news gathering, the watchdog journalism that is part of what makes the community work and part of what holds institutions accountable, but also, rather than agenda setting, more of that community's public square. Because I do think that where the successful local media organization is one that is a place where diverse viewpoints can be shared and a variety of different opinions can be put out there and then put against the expert opinion and the news of the day. It's the water cooler for the community, for lack of a better description. And I think that function can be preserved, even though the economic challenges that we're all facing can seem to be pretty daunting.
I want to agree with Mizell a lot on everything he said, and I do think we're in a really big transition period right now. You can get information almost everywhere now. There are blogs, there are websites, there's Facebook, but there will come, there's a saturation point at which people will be overwhelmed, and frankly, I'm sort of there now, by everything that's out there. And I do believe that people will turn to more traditional news organizations like the Evansville Courier and Press, like the Indianapolis Star, like the Louisville Courier Journal or Wish TV, because they believe those places are trustworthy. The key is for all of these organizations to remain relevant through that period. And the concern is that there are so many cuts, there is so much going on, that it will be hard for some of those folks to stay relevant through that period, through this big transition period.
I try real hard, you know, in doing this program, not to take sides or take issues. But this one's, I think everybody realizes, the blanket disclosure is pretty close to me and the work that I've done. So I'm letting the audience know right now. I think one of my worries about all of this is I agree with Leslie, frankly. I think legacy traditional media are going to weather this storm, maybe in somewhat altered form. What I worry about at the other side of this, though, is because information is always going to be valuable, that the people who can pay for it, who can pay directly for content, will have a distinct advantage. That in some ways, advertising and this advertising business model that media leveled the playing field and made it much more democratic. In other words, you know, it didn't matter if you shopped at the most expensive department store in town. You still got to, for your 50 cents or your 75 cents, or back when I started, your quarter, you still got access to all of the same information that the person who did shop at that store did.
And but, John, if you really think about the news ecosystem, what is produced by, just taking it to a national level, what's produced by the New York Times, I mean, they are in the process of rolling out a subscription model, a paywall, if you will, and they have got to do that in order to sustain the revenue stream that they need for their news gathering. Those stories eventually make it outside of the Times ecosystem and to broadcast outlets, to other news organizations, but what you're paying for is that ability to get it first.
Mm-hmm. Well, and is that the case though? Right now, one of the things that I think we explore is a lot of the new media models, frankly, are aggregate models where they pull by that. And I chided Ken a little earlier for not using terms like that. I probably ought to chide myself right now. By that, it means that often with these new media, they are doing just that. They're pulling stories that have appeared elsewhere first and presenting them to their audience. If they don't have that first source, or that first source cuts off access to the news and content, what do they have to sell?
Right. And 2 points. I think, number one, Mizell's right. The Times is putting up a wall. There are other outlets you can get that information from down the road. But I think we'll see more and more walls as time goes by. And so the delay between the time that story appears in the Times and it appears in some guy's inbox in Roanoke may be getting greater and greater, becoming greater and greater over time. But the second thing is, I think Leslie pointed out the point of relevance. I think that one of the challenges traditional media have going forward is there is a subsection of America, and they're on the left, they're on the right, and they're in the middle, who believe that the media does have some kind of secret agenda, that we have newsroom meetings every day and put up political posters and, you know, chant slogans, which has never happened, of course. But that view is out there. And what they are finding in the new media are voices that are just like theirs. And so there are some people in our society that are pushing aside the New York Times, the Washington Post, the whatever, because Joe Smith's blog on politics is right up their alley. And Joe Smith is the only guy that really has the idea. And as crazy as that sounds, I think that we're moving into an era where the media has to be very aggressive, about making the case for what they do, being more transparent about what they do. And we're probably close to a point in our culture, and I'd advocate strongly for this, where we need media education in schools. Just like we teach kids how to drive a car at 16, just like we tell them, you know, how to or not have
or
sex when they're 12.
Or balance a checkbook or anything else that's important.
But this is where information comes
actually,
from.
We have that education in many high schools. It's called high school journalism programs. I was actually at a session making a presentation before 35 high school journalism teachers from across the country in an annual institute on Monday, and heard something at that session that that warmed my heart as we were talking about new media and all of the different ways that information can be created and distributed. One of the teachers said to me that her students prefer their stories going into print because print is permanent.
And I will say, as someone who works with a lot of college students these days, even though they may have a wider distribution of their stuff on the web, they get far more excited about seeing something in print for just that reason, Mizell. Well, I want to ask real quickly, though, on this one. Well, and I guess I should say that whole idea of, again, I'm going to disclose the fact that I'm expressing my own view here. When I hear that talk of the media conspiracy or whatever, I think having spent maybe 30 years in newsrooms, realizing a conspiracy isn't possible, it's a miracle the paper came out every day. The places are so disorganized.
I tell folks that if I was part of all the conspiracies I'm accused of, I would not have to come to work every day.
But again, I want to argue then, what is it? Because we have to realize that the audience at some level does have the last word here. What is it that traditional or legacy media weren't giving these folks that persuaded them to look elsewhere?
But I don't think they're looking elsewhere. Our audience, when I look at the people that our local media organization reaches in print, on the internet, on television, on radio, in magazines, we reach more people than we ever have before. The challenge is monetizing that audience.
Mizell, can I push back very friendly, in a very friendly way, just a little bit? I think the one thing that the non-traditional media folks do very, very well when they do it well is extreme localism. In other words, as budgets in newsrooms have been cut back, you're seeing more and more wire copy, you're seeing more and more syndicated stuff, and it's not an indictment of anybody, it's the fact of the matter. You've got fewer people in the newsroom, you've got to fill the paper up somehow. And I think that there are some people out there that are doing a really good job of explaining what's happening in their towns, their cities, their communities, even their blocks, in ways that might be almost too quaint for traditional media to do.
I don't know. Gannett did an experiment with some micro journalism products. I think it was in New Jersey, and they were not particularly successful. So I'm not sure that people really want a traditional news organization to provide that really micro. I think they'd almost rather get that from their neighborhood newsletter or from their neighborhood blog. I think what people want from traditional media and the Evansville Courier and Press is to provide the information that people need to make better decisions about Evansville and about the surrounding area. The problem is just what Mizell was saying, that if you can't monetize that right now in this very difficult period, then you do have to make cuts that then affect your ability to do that. It's sort of a chicken and egg problem.
I do agree that the wrong approach for local media organizations that are under a great deal of financial stress, the wrong approach is to fill the news hole with wire copy, or in a broadcast sense, to be less local by taking yes, everybody cares about health, but you know, I really want to see that report about procedure that's happening at my local hospital rather than something that's happening at the Mayo Clinic and that's transmitted in kind of a canned way. I think I agree agree that the challenge, even as we contract in terms of resources that we have available, is to maintain and in some cases enhance the caliber of local journalism. And from my standpoint, in my perch in Evansville, what we really focus on doing is saying, what are those areas that are inviolate? In other words, I'm not going. There are some areas that I'm just not going to compromise. You know, Evansville is going to have a correspondent in Indianapolis. Why? Because sorry, folks in Indianapolis, but I don't think half of y'all really know Evansville exists. So we want to make sure that we have a presence in the state capitol for our readers. Once upon a time we had a full-time Washington correspondent. Well, I can't afford that, but I still have somebody there who is watching what's going on with our U.S. senators, what's happening with Indiana's congressional delegation. That person's not working full-time for us, but we still have that presence. And so we've got to be a little bit more creative than we have been in the past. But again, the major issue being we local media organizations really have to define what are the most important areas and ensure that those most important areas are done well and done deeply and done by local people.
We are talking about the changes and challenges confronting the news business. We're fortunate to have as our guest Leslie Stedman Weidenbender, formerly the State House Bureau Chief for Louisville Courier-Journal, Ken Owen, currently with DePauw University, and Mizell Stewart, editor of the Evansville Courier and Press. I'm John Krall. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking about the changes and challenges confronting the news business with our guests, Mizell Stewart of the Evansville Courier and Press, Leslie Stedman Weidenbender, formerly of the Louisville Courier Journal, and Ken Owen, now with DePauw University, but a longtime television and radio anchor with WIBC and WISH-TV. I should also say that we extended an invitation to Dennis Ryerson, the editor of The Star, to join us, and weren't able to make the schedules match up. But I want to let our listeners know that. Also would invite our listeners to join the program by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can send a comment or question via Twitter or Facebook at WFYI. We've gotten some email questions, and I think probably to deal with that. One comes from Sharon Dunton, and she says, I am one of the 700 laid off from Gannett. I've been advised that I should obtain training in convergence journalism, online, broadcast, and print. Where do professional journalists fit in after 20 years in print? Mizell, I think that one's probably in your wheelhouse, so we'll throw that one back to you.
Professional journalists fit in everywhere. I think the challenge really is how many people do we have in order to meet those core functions. You know, several years ago here in Evansville, I had a writer who spent a great deal of his time covering the local zoo, and I love the zoo. I think the animals are wonderful things, but I'm not sure I needed to have a full-time professional journalist doing that. And so we ended up making a decision in a round of cuts that particular general assignment reporting position was not necessary. I do think that, and in fact we're hiring here in Evansville right now. I do believe that again, a lot of the issues that have put a lot of journalist jobs under great pressure have had to do with the way that those companies have operated, that has compounded the revenue decline. Perfect example being I was caught up in this myself in 2005 and 2006 in a series of newspaper deals that led to my departure from two newspapers in a period of 18 months due to ownership changes. And new owners came in and had borrowed a great deal of money in order to acquire those newspapers and realized that they were not going to be able to service the debt that they'd had to take on in order to make that acquisition, as well as operating the enterprise without having to significantly reduce their costs. And so I think some of the issues that are roiling newspapers in particular are self-inflicted by those managers who quite literally, in some cases, bought at the top of the market.
Leslie Stedman-Weidminner.
I think that, too, the idea that there are unemployed journalists, professional journalists out there looking for new things to do, the truth is there's really no better time to try to jump into this new world that we're talking about. You know, Indiana lacks really for strong online news organizations, and there's no reason to think that, like there have been in other states, that there aren't real opportunities for great news gathering organizations that could be started, run online, maybe put behind a paywall, doing all those kinds of things. I think there's a lot of exciting possibilities out there for people who want to take a little bit of a chance.
And let me just say, it's very easy to, taking this from another perspective, I just want to say publicly how much I respect the people who are still in the news business, number one, but the news managers who probably have the most difficult job in the world, the people that have to make these personnel decisions. It's easy to vilify. It's easy to say, gee, you know, why are they making these cuts? They're coming from another place, and they're actors in a play that's playing itself out. But I just want to say publicly that everybody that's in there fighting the fight is fighting a good fight. It's a tough fight, and I do hope we emerge from this in better shape than we are right now.
We've gotten another email question, although I'm not sure this one goes to any of you, but probably to me. It says, is it appropriate for college and university journalism schools to continue to promote their degrees as preparation for working journalists who can earn a living wage? So few writers, producers, photographers can be employed full-time at news outlets, web, print, broadcast, etc., that I would suggest it is unethical to promote news journalism as a career. If someone else wants to take that's fine.
Well,
myself.
John, let me step up on that in particular, because if you remember when I mentioned before, you know, how you had the home builder in Phoenix saying, you know, we'd rather drive people to our own websites. I do think that what we're going to see is an explosion of content being created by commercial interests, and I for one would be thrilled if folks who had training in gathering information and verifying information were also involved in doing that. I think that what the internet has done in terms of leveling the playing field for everyone is it has turned everyone into a content creator, and we need people who are media literate and who also have the skills of writing, editing, and photography to be able to create content, whether it is for a pure journalistic purpose or whether it's for a commercial message.
Ken Owen.
The skills are transferable. I agree entirely, and I'm living proof of that. And it's like asking, why do you have a political science major if the person isn't going to pursue a career in politics?
Yeah, run for president. Yeah, he's a failure.
There are so many things you can do with a degree, and I think that the great thing about people that are trained as journalists is that they think and question and write. And again, those skills are very transferable in a courtroom setting, a newsroom, a political campaign. There are many, many things you can do with that degree.
I just don't believe for one minute that there is going to be an absence of news gathering. We're just working out what the how we're going to make money off of that and how it's going to be supported financially, and we're working out what the platforms are going to be in the future. But there is going to be a demand for news gatherers. The only thing unethical for a university or a college to do would be to train journalists only to participate in old media. And when I say that, I mean old media the way it used to be done. Newspapers and TV and radio, they're all branching out into new and exciting things, and you're going to need new young journalists to do those things.
Well, and I will, since the question, I guess, is the only one on the program who actually has to run a journalism school, probably I owe the listener an answer, and that is that Leslie's answer is the one I would offer, is that really it is about training them to perform the traditional function of journalists with the idea that the way that you deliver the information is going to change and evolve. You may have to get used to some new business models that are going to be coming down, but really, I agree. I think at the end of the day that there are going to be always going to be people who need to have the skills to gather information, news and information, and deliver it to people. I guess what I'd come back to is place kind of where we started, I think, with Mizell at the beginning of the program when we talked about the big budgets of the 80s and the 90s. Historically now, when we look back, was that the anomaly? Because it does seem like I remember being in the business too when Ken was talking about the 35-40% profit margins. I don't think at the paper ours were ever quite that high, but they were, you know, above 25% at times. And, you know, realistically, there's no other business that counts on margins, like no other legal business.
But John, don't you think this is a product of a larger thing? This is not just a journalism problem. I mean, this is a problem with public ownership, with the demand for profit. I think you could probably look across a number of industries and see places where shareholders are demanding cuts, they're demanding higher profits, and the result is that the people at the bottom who are doing the producing are getting squeezed. And so I think that this is actually a much larger issue than just a journalistic one.
Well, and that's the other. I'm going to take your point and move it ever so slightly here, and that is that one of the things that I hear is that, you know, when something like this hits the news business, journalists scream. But the reality is, you know, the steel industry is not what it was 40 years ago, that there have been all sorts of other businesses that have had to go through tremendously painful transition. What makes journalists any different?
And the music industry is actually suffering the same thing. People think music is just created and is out there for free to be had, and news stories require professionals and time and people. I think it's interesting to think back when I was a boy, and I'm 50 years old now, but when I was a boy, there was a half an hour of news on local television at 6 and a half an hour at 11 or 10, depending on where you lived. And the stations essentially presented news as a public service up until about 1973 or 4 when they realized it was a cash cow. It was something you had to do because you had to be relicensed by the FCC, and so you put something on the air. And it was less about breaking news or putting things on the air that were live than actually recapping what had happened in a day's time, whether or not you had pictures. And through the satellite technology and all the things we've morphed through, where we are today, where one local station, I think, starts at 4 in the morning and goes to like 10. I mean, it's going to be like a 24-hour exercise show before long. You know, you just never get off the treadmill. And I think that speaks to a lot of the problem, is that news became this profit center. They realized they could have X number of people in the newsroom, do X number of hours of news. Syndicated programming like Oprah was $1 million a week at one point. I don't know what she was charging at the end. But it became unrealistic to buy programming, so you created it yourself. And on the other hand, as Leslie said, we had these publicly owned companies that were saying, you know, the profit margin was this 20 years ago. We need to at least have this. And so I think it was an unsustainable model. Mm-hmm. Going forward, I think two things have to happen. The owners of media companies probably have to be more realistic about what they're going to get back in terms of profit. And the media companies are going to have to do, and I think they're doing a very good job of it right now, actually, but honing their product to hit the audience that's out there and convincing those people in the younger generation that what they do is valuable and viable.
Leslie Stedman Weidenbender.
Well, I mean, I think it's a very complicated question going forward about mm-hmm. how you hone that product and about how you create a product that that is valuable to people and still requires people to pay for it. And I mean, I just think that's what we're all working out right now. It's very difficult.
Mizell, I'm going to toss this since you're actively in the business right now. What do you hope the Evansville Courier and Press looks like 5 years from now?
Really, the idea from our perspective is taking advantage of scale from a different level. I mean, one of the things, again, that has really challenged individual local media organizations are national players who are, you know, essentially coming in and taking chunks of our business. And I talk about it from a business standpoint, because without business, there is no journalism at the level that we have and our readers have become accustomed to. And so what we have to do is literally to figure out how do we expand our local footprint so as to be able to serve both our readers and our advertisers in every possible way. You know, how do we take our content and adapt it for every single platform? We launched an iPad app in the last 2 weeks because we think that the tablets are going to be one of the next big things. But in 5 years, I want to be actively delivering news and information and serving the community on every platform, and we're within striking distance of that.
Mizell, if you don't mind me asking, do you expect in 5 years you'll still be actually printing a product, and in 20 years do you think you'll still be actually printing?
I believe so, and for a number of different reasons. Number one, I thank God every day for medical advances, because people are living longer, and there is still a very robust audience for a traditional daily printed newspaper. We made a number of changes to the newspaper a couple of years back in order to make sure that our costs stayed in line with revenue, and people told me over and over again, you know, I understand what you all are doing, but please do these two things for me. Keep the newspaper local and keep it alive.
We have got just under a minute left here, so I'm just going to take it around real quickly. Have we seen the worst of the changes right now? Leslie Stedman,
I don't think so. I think it might get a little worse yet, because I think everybody's still trying to figure this out, but hopefully the end is not far away.
Ken Owen.
I think the step the Times is taking is a step in the right direction in rejiggering the way people think about what they get and what they should be paying for it. But I agree with Leslie. There's a ways to go.
Mizell Stewart, you're going to have the last word. You've got about 15, 20 seconds to deliver.
I think it depends on the company, and I think it depends on the community. It will vary from market to market.
We have been talking about the changes and challenges confronting the news business here on No Limits, and I would like to thank each of my guests for joining us today. Leslie Stedman Weidenbender, formerly the State House Bureau Chief for the Indiana State House with the Louisville Courier-Journal. Leslie, always a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Ken Owen, now with DePaul University, longtime reporter and anchor, though, with WIBC and WISH-TV. Always good to spend time with you, too.
An extreme pleasure, John. Thank you.
And Mizell Stewart, we didn't actually get to sit face-to-face with each other, but talking with you by phone is always a pleasure. You were with the Evansville Courier and Press. Thank you for joining us today.
Very enjoyable. Thank you so much.
We will be back next week. Please stay with us. I also would like to thank all of our listeners, the ones who sent us questions and participated in this conversation. Talk with you again next week. I'm John Krull. Take care.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alsett. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Jeanette Rhodes, and board engineer, Matthew Sosi. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.